All right, we're back. It's good to be back. Welcome back to Evil Thespian Podcast. We are here with, this is Editing Maddie from the future. I am re-recording this introduction because I royally messed it up so bad in this episode, and I want to do my lovely, lovely guests right. So I am here today with Michael Ortiz and Nicholas Turturro, two loyal stewards of Serials. Serials is an episodic short play competition series featuring some of New York's hottest actors, directors, and playwrights in the indie theater scene. Nicholas Turturro is the marketing director and a participating artist. Michael Ortiz is the producer and host of Serials. He is also the co-artistic director of Breaking and Entering Theater Collective, Evil Thespian, Serials. Let's get into it.
Yeah.
Perfect.
You got this. I believe you.
Every single I've been doing this for like 2.5 years, and every single time. Welcome to the show, guys. Now that that's over. How is everyone doing? What a time to be alive and have a show.
Yeah, in the midst of this third little stint of winter, you know?
Okay.
I mean, like,
yes.
Come on.
Yeah. I was gonna ask, and I don't know if you can see the snow is like really coming down outside. But yeah, it's weird. Is it snowing
Wait,
where you guys are?
Maddie, yeah, no. Where are you calling from, Maddie?
Oh, I am calling from Chicago.
Oh, sweet.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, no snow in New York, but we're under a flood watch, which is
equally as
just
fun.
Such a bummer. Yeah.
See, that's how I feel about New York. I would move there in a heartbeat, but I do feel like if the world ended tomorrow, I would probably be safe because I'm in the middle, smack dab in the middle of the country where nothing happens. And I just feel like I'm kind of in the middle of the island a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. Absolutely. I've kind of wanted to go to Chicago for like a hot minute. My partner's cousin's out there. I've got some friends out there.
I haven't
been before.
Oh my gosh. You never been?
Never been.
Oh my gosh. I love when people come into Chicago like just as tourists, because then it gives me an excuse to leave my apartment. And yeah, that's awesome though. No, I was born and raised here. I've lived and worked here most of my life, so... Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but now in New York, in like Tribeca, there's like a fake little replica of the Bean. It's like a fraction of the scale. They're really trying to be
supporting...
like, New York's got its own Bean. It's not impressive.
No, because it's also supporting like a luxury high rise that looks half empty. So it's the saddest Bean you can imagine.
Yeah.
Not the Millennium Park Bean.
I think it might be the building that like Taylor Swift used to live in, doesn't live in. I don't know.
Maybe.
There are like a lot of celebrities in that neighborhood. It's weird.
Wow. I haven't been to the Tribeca area in like a hot minute, but I have seen a picture of this pseudo Bean, and I mean there's nothing quite like it. I always think it's really funny, like big statues like that, because they do have to clean the Bean on a regular basis, and I just think that's kind of a funny concept because it's just like a big blob of like a shiny silver chrome thing. And I don't know, we really spend some cash over here to take good care of stuff like that for some reason.
Have you ever seen the Bean getting cleaned?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. All the time. We take really good care of our very few historical landmarks here. So you guys are both in New York. How long have you guys been in New York?
So I think Michael's got a little bit of time on me, but I've been here for a little over 5 years now.
Yeah, nice. This is, for me, this is year 7.
Wow. The 7, yeah. There's something about the year 7, because when I got to, like, my 7-year, like, working out of college, something about it.
Yeah,
it
feels
kind of
biblical.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say if you maintain a friendship for 7 years, that's a friend for life. So maybe there's a correlation there with the city you live in.
Yeah.
Wow, that's beautiful.
That is beautiful. Yeah. I have asked...
I promise I didn't make it up.
Could have told me. I like it.
I always ask how people's relationship with New York has changed in the past, like, even 5 years, every 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like your relationship to the city you live in, especially if, like, you live in, like, a very, like, you know, busy metropolitan area, everything is always changing. But how has your relationships with New York, like, changed over the years?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because my relationship with New York has been, I mean, I love New York, but it's, I came in at an interesting time because I moved here in 2019, had like 8 months of like, oh, I'm an actor in New York right out of grad or undergrad. And then 2020 hit, and then it was like 2020, and then all the social unrest of that time, and then the strike. And then, like, so it's been a very tumultuous time to move to New York. But if anything, like, I mean, for me, it's like, I still love it. And it really is a, like, well, I've been through all of that, so I'm not scared of what's coming next. Like,
nothing
if anything,
scares. Yeah. No, I totally get that. Where you're like, because my biggest failure, like, in my character is just like, how bad could it possibly be? And yeah, it turns out I'm like, wow, it keeps getting more exciting every time. So yeah, it definitely relates.
Yeah, you know, city loves to keep us on our toes.
Yes.
I don't know. I feel like my relationship with New York, like, my family is from here, like, you know, New Yorkerican from Spanish Harlem.
Yeah.
But I grew up in Florida because my grandparents retired and a bunch of people on my mom's side of the family, like, followed them down there. But I spent, like, a lot of my childhood coming up here all the time. Like, it felt like a really easy transition, a very easy move. And I don't know, like, I personally feel like I'm in a bit of a different situation than a lot of folks who live out here, in the sense of, like, I've only had to live in one apartment the entire time. I feel like everyone else who I know is, like, moving all the time because apartments are crazy out here.
Yeah.
And I've just fallen into, like, a lucky situation where I got a good deal and I've been able to stay in this apartment for 7 years. And I feel like I've just, like, really settled in and gotten very homey. So, like, when COVID, you know, when the pandemic did happen and there was that whole lockdown, it was actually kind of funny because my partner, who we had been together for a long time already, for years, but she moved up and moved in maybe like 4 or 5 months before everything shut down. So then it was just kind of like the two of us holed up in our apartment, locked in here. And I felt like it was very make or break for a lot of couples. And for us, it was very make. Like, we had a lot of time to really, like, settle in and just get very, like, cozy. And I don't know, it's weird. Like, it feels a lot homier than I think I would have expected it to, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, you have a really nice fireplace in the background, which I envy.
I will never use it. Yeah.
There's no way you can, Michael. There's
no way it works.
Way.
I think we'll
Don't
all
try
die.
It.
I think if anything, there was one time back in, I think it was 2021, I had a couple mice in the apartment, and I'm pretty sure that they got in through, like, a little hole in the chute that we had to, like, plug up with steel wool. Like, I'm like, I'm never opening that thing. I don't want to know what's in there.
Oh my gosh. See, mine.
Perfectly decorative.
Yeah.
No, Michael, that's actually interesting. I don't think we've ever really put the, we actually have similar family stories with our relationships to New York, which I didn't realize, because my grandparents came in through, they were through Ellis Island, and actually most of my, like, family lived in Brooklyn, and then they also moved to Florida. Now, granted, we didn't get back up as frequently as it sounds like you did, but that's interesting, like, that we both have those familial ties back to the city.
The Floridian roots.
Southern New York roots,
I love Florida so much. Whereabouts in Florida? For both of you guys, I guess.
So I was born in Florida. I actually spent most of my, I spent half my time in Massachusetts and then the other half of my time in Georgia growing up, and then moved to New York. So Florida's like the place that I have visited enough that I'm very familiar, but haven't actually, like, lived there.
Gotcha.
I grew up in Orlando, so you
Nice.
know, theme parks in the backyard are very
Where
like,
dreams come true.
yeah, I think it's like all the stereotypes that people think about when they think about living in Florida, you see them all in Orlando. So yeah, I grew up there, and then I went to University of Florida in Gainesville, which is very interesting. I love Gainesville. It's
University
like
of Florida.
I felt like it was like a very much a college town, very like classic college experience. I've heard it's very different now. I haven't been back since I graduated in 2017, but it's in this weird like little geographical sector of the state because you're like technically in North Florida, but you're in like the southernmost tip of North Florida. And I don't know, like you get north enough in Florida, you're basically in Alabama. So take that how you will.
And did both of you guys study theater in undergrad? Cool. And both acting, anything specific? How did you guys like kind of get into theater originally?
I got into theater. I went to a public school in Georgia, but it had a really strong, like, it's very well supported theater department. And I took class. I just took like a random class, like sophomore year of high school. And originally, I thought I was gonna go into marine biology, and then like right before senior year, I was like having a conversation with my parents, and I was like, I think I want to do acting instead. And it was funny because my mom wanted to do acting, and she never really got to pursue it, so she was pretty like she was very supportive, and my dad was too. But he was like, well, you're gonna make about the same amount of money whether you're a marine biologist or an actor. So what, just do whichever one you like better. And I was like, honestly, yeah, he's right. 'Cause me doing research on a boat versus like having a survival job in New York, it's about the gonna pay about the same. But so I
And
went
also
to
equally as dangerous sometimes.
True. But so I went to Syracuse, and I got my BFA in acting, and I graduated in 2019 with that.
Awesome.
Yeah, I got into doing theater, I think, when I was in like middle school. I was already just really like fixated with TV and like live performance. I used to like watch old Abbott and Costello movies at home, and I would like make my parents sit down in front of the TV while I would like put the movie on and then like do the entire scene in front of them that like we were watching. So I was really always like a ham, even from like a young age. But I think it was in the sixth grade that was like the first time I ever, no, sixth or seventh? Seventh grade, I guess. Yeah. I went to Catholic school. So it was like a small school, and everybody did like a little bit of everything. And like, I don't know, I guess it was a little different than the like stereotypes you see in like TV and movies where like kids doing theater was like considered cool. And I was like, I want to do it.
I had that experience kind of in that was kind of my experience in college and a little bit in high school. It's a kind of a weird thing. Later in my high school career, a bunch of like popular kids started doing theater and it just became like the cool thing to do. And then when I went to college, being a theater major and like an actor, that was like a very stonery thing to do. Like, oh, cool, stoner philosophy, acting theory kind of thing to do. It was like, and also it was like, it just, not very stereotypically like female dominated. It was like a lot of straight guys and like very cool. We were like the jocks almost, which is very strange.
I love that for us, though.
So, definitely. Once I graduated, university, I felt very clouded up and like ready to step a fan kick through life. And now we have this podcast. But I'm super interested in kind of how I know we kind of talked about we do a little bit of everything over here, but how did Serials like come to be? What was sort of the impetus behind this show, and how did you guys get started?
So the big thing to know, Serials, I think of it as this like big mythic thing that's got a very long storied history that predates us because we are not the founders or creators of cereals. I really like to think of us sort of as the stewards of it, almost, if that makes sense. So to give you kind of a long backstory
truncated,
short, I'm going to give you the abridged version. So back in the day, about 13 years ago, Cereals was founded by some members of the Bats, which used to be the resident artist company based out of the Fleet Theater. Nick and I were both Bats. That's how we met each other. And the show, well, not even the show, I guess, like, sort of the Bats, the whole claim to fame behind the company was that it was like the largest, most diverse non-union company of actors, of resident actors at a theater in New York City. And that was true. But when you have that large of a company, there's unfortunately not space or opportunity for everybody to be able to do their thing and showcase themselves. So the artists really sort of took matters into their own hands and created this program that was essentially by the Bats for the Bats. It's gone on through many iterations. The Bats no longer exist. And then the show moved with us to a collective that we started called the Fled Collective, and now has gone on to become its own independent thing. But I would say that we have really sort of come into, I don't even want to say possession of it, because I don't think that it belongs to us, but we've sort of been leading the charge on the program since about 2019, 2020. It's gone through a few different iterations. We tried to do it virtually over Zoom back in the 2020 days, if you remember that Zoom theater,
that did not work. But that is generally the story of Zoom.
I mean, I can't imagine, because, I mean, there are times even doing this podcast, like, there's so many things you can't control with the Wi-Fi. Some people, you know, don't pay that extra $10 that I have to pay for, like, nice, not very speedy internet. But I can't, I mean, I can't imagine.
So it's been, it's just been like a very long journey with it. I have personally been involved with Cereals since 2018. And so I started out acting in the show, and then I became a team captain. Nick is a team captain now and could definitely tell you a little bit more about what that's like. And then I started associate producing, and then things just kind of rolled, and now I produce the show with we're a team of five.
And I think it's also worth noting, Michael, the that where Cereals currently sits, like, in this in the timeline of this program, is Cereals currently sits in a unique position, at least unique for us, as long as we've been a part of it. It's kind of the first time where the programming is pretty much independent, right? Like, so when we did it at the, when we did it with the Bats, that was under that was under an institution. When we did it with the Fled, that was under a collective as part of their programming. And this is kind of the first time since we've been involved that the programming is independent of any oversight, with the exception of the kind of general oversight the theater we're operating in provides. But we are not beholden, though we love the theater we're in right now, but we're not beholden at the moment to kind of any sort of institution, which is refreshing.
That's interesting. Our hot girl summer, so to speak.
Well, that's actually, I'm really interested in kind of what defines independent programming. And I know you mentioned kind of you're not sort of beholden to an institution or another, like, parent collective. Is there a difference in terms of, like, the new things that influence how the current programming is organized?
I think something just, the benefit of working underneath an institution is institutional support, right? So that comes in the form of money, resources, personnel, et cetera, right? The challenge with it is that, generally speaking, you know, those things that cat visitor.
Cute.
Can't see this video and are listening. But the challenge with that is that, you know, in an institution, if an institution's giving you resources, they've got say in how the programming operates, right? So, you know, being independent means that, you know, any of the resources that we do have, we have to, you know, bring up ourselves, right? Which mm-hmm. can be challenging. But it also gives us the capability to run things organizationally the way that we think is best for the artists. It gives us, you know, we're not beholden. Yeah, we're not beholden mm-hmm. to anyone's rules except our own and the general rules of the space that we're in, which are going to mm-hmm. be the obvious rules of a theater, which is treat it with respect, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for this current group, which has a lot of very independently minded, you know, forward thinking people, it's a real benefit to be independent.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I agree. I can't imagine handling someone else's money, mostly because I'm so nervous about being responsible for what goes where, or someone showed up or not supposed to. It's very, very stressful, but that's really interesting. So can you give sort of, I guess, for the listeners that are not familiar, sort of a like an overview of how the programming, like how the show runs?
Oh, Michael, you want to give that elevator pitch?
Oh, yeah. You yeah, better believe pitch. I'm cracking my knuckles over here. Like, y'all ain't even ready. So, Serials is an episodic late night short play competition series. The way that it operates, 5 short plays go in, the audience votes on their favorites, and then at the end of the weekend, the top 3 shows that are voted the winners come back the next week with a new episode of the same storyline, and then the other 2 groups come back with something completely new. So every weekend of shows, it's always different programming. You're getting to see new work in different stages of development every week. We've got some shows that are in their first episode or in their pilot, as we refer to it, you know, sort of like a sitcom. And then we've got some shows that are on episode 5 or 6. I think back in the heyday, we had some shows that went as long as maybe like 14 9, episodes.
14, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And so it's been a really great incubator for new work. In the last 3 years alone, we've seen 5 full-length plays get developed out of Serials, which has been really awesome to just kind of be on the ground floor of that and help all these artists make really cool connections. A lot of people meet their best friends and their most frequent collaborators in Serials.
Wow. I mean, do people come into it with like a premeditated idea, or maybe like a crumb of like an idea, and then kind of grow it as like, you know, the audience votes and everything? Or is it a little bit more like spontaneous?
I would say we get a little bit of both. You know, I don't think I've ever seen anybody come in with an idea for a serial that they were like, man, I'm already coming in with a full like 5 mm-hmm. episode arc. I know what I'm going to do. I think a part of the fun and the challenge of the show is that the writers don't necessarily, you know, they might have maybe a general idea of like something that they want to do in terms of like a genre or a vibe, but we are our producing team. We're the ones who sort of just pair up all the artists together. So it'll be like a team of actors gets assigned to a writer and a director. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes the writers are meeting the actors for the first time when they're coming in to write their pilot episode. So we give them, you know, a whole breakdown of who these actors are, you know, what are the things that they typically do and the things that they typically get cast in, and what are things that they never really get to mm-hmm. do, but that they really want to. So it's a really fun challenge for everyone to just sort of have all these different crumbs and pieces to sort of put together into something. You know, writers really sort of thrive with getting to meet the actors mm-hmm. where they're at and collaborate on developing something. And then typically after a pilot gets voted back, then the writers will start generating like, okay, I think I have a bigger idea of where I want this to go now, if that makes sense.
And I'd even say, like, on top of that, like, I'd even say we probably are actively, like, we don't want writers coming in with 5 episodes prepared, because part of something that is really great about serials is, I mean, the spontaneity from multiple perspectives, including the logistical perspectives. You might not have the same amount of actors you had the previous week. They might, you might have, we have a show that's running right now that I think they've had literally an entire a different cast every single week. Like,
Every week,
entirely different.
with
So
the
these are people.
exception of like maybe like one or two people
Yeah.
here and there, like, but even then, it's like they kind of those actors have kind of cycled in and out. I'm sorry, I like fully interrupted you, Nick.
No, no,
Please
no.
keep
We're, no, no,
going.
no. You didn't interrupt. You're adding, you're supplementing. But yeah, so there really is, I mean, part of the magic of this programming is the fact that we don't want you to know where it's going to go. We want to figure it out as we're getting there, you know? And that's where, like, I mean, I think some of the best moments of the programming have come out in these totally, like, total surprises of, like, I don't know where this is going from a script perspective, from a directing perspective. I don't know what actors I have. I like all these variables, but it's kind of, and I think it's part of what makes the actors that participate in serials particularly, with, they have a unique skill set, which is that, like, the flexibility and adaptability that you develop doing this stuff is A, a benefit to everything you do, and B, like, part of the serial's magic. Like, you're going to get a script. It's not going to be what you expect, and that's exciting.
It also sounds to me like such a great writing exercise just in general overall, because I think a lot of things that you'll hear from writers and directors a lot is that they are so obsessed with actors in general because that is where sort of like the best ideas come from, and that is where sort of the inspiration comes from. I always hear this from people because I am often astonished at how cool writers think actors are. I'm always like, oh, I have not me. So, but it's a great environment to be where like you meet someone and they're like so excited about like, wait, I know exactly where to put you.
Yeah, and it's also there's a fun challenge element in the turnaround for it as well. It is a very quick and dirty process. Our writers typically we try to give them like a solid week to write their scripts. Way back in the day, writers were turning new episodes around with like a 48-hour turnaround, and we're like, let's give the writers a little bit more time, just so that they could breathe a little bit. But when the actors and the director get into the room, each team only has about 5 hours of rehearsal. We utilize Zoom now when the scripts come in to give everybody one chance to just like hop on for an hour and do a quick read through and ask any initial questions. But then once we get in the room, each team has 2 days of rehearsal. Each rehearsal is 2.5 hours long. And then you tech the show for 30 minutes. And then that same day of tech, you throw it up on stage and you do 3 nights of performances. And then once it's gone, it's gone. So it's really, it's very spontaneous. And I think that's something that we really aim to keep in the process for, it keeps us all on our toes in a way that really energizes everyone who's involved.
And there's quite a range with these scripts too. I mean, that's because sometimes you're really stretching, which is fun and sometimes very stressful, but also always fun. Like, I mean, I've had episodes where I've gone through a script and been like, great, this character is straightforward, you know, a handful of lines that should be easy to memorize. This is a cakewalk for these two rehearsals. And then I've had ones where the writers come in and want to include two musical numbers and choreography, or a fight, or like a whole choreographed fight scene in a 10-minute play. And
Oh,
then you're
I
like,
know
all
exactly what
right.
you're talking about too. You're
It's,
like,
I mean, it's that
oh.
balance, yeah.
We had one serial back maybe like a year and a half ago that was called One Long Fight. And that was the thing. That was the whole shtick of it, was that it was just a little bit of dialogue here and there interspersed throughout just like 7 to 8 minutes of fight choreography that
Wow.
these people have like 2 days to learn and then do on stage. It's wild.
Wow. I'd be reading the the law. For me, anytime, well, this is my question. For like the spontaneity part of it, I always get nervous when people like bring in like super ambitious ideas because my brain immediately goes to like, what could I possibly be liable for? Have you ever seen a play come in and it is like something like you don't expect or you just like couldn't did not anticipate? Like stuff happens all the time, like people throw things, people accidentally kick each other in the face. Has that ever happened before?
I don't think no one's ever gotten injured as far as I'm
Okay.
concerned. Yeah, I mean, I think if I mean
No.
we've had I think we've learned some lessons of like just making sure that everyone is comfortable with the material that they're getting and to like set up any kind of like boundaries ahead of time because the process is such a tight turnaround that it's better to know that kind of stuff. And obviously if someone has a change of heart or like is just like I can't do this material, that is you know, we accommodate that kind of stuff, but to put in kind of these safety structures in place before even the first read happens, before the writer has even begun to type out, you know, the first couple lines, that has been definitely quite helpful for keeping everyone safe, like mentally, and then from a physical perspective. I mean, even with that, like one long fight was seriously choreographed. I think, you know, the people. The only reason we were able to do that were the people that were a part of it were capable of doing it. And you know, we always make sure someone's so there's always a fight call. There's always you know, a fight director, right? You know, we want to make sure people are having a lot of fun. And you know, it's okay to be stressed about, you know, being like, oh God, do I have it? But are safe about it. You know, that's definitely very important.
Yeah, 100%. We feel very fortunate that we've got a couple in-house folks who regularly participate in the show who do have certifications for fight choreography and stage combat. So, they're always making sure that everything is being done in a very safe, approachable way. When we've needed to, we've even been able to bring in people to help do like intimacy choreography and direction. Because it's such a tight turnaround and the artists don't necessarily know what they're going to get until they get their scripts, it also creates this tight turnaround where we need to make sure that everybody is able to consent to what they're doing ahead of time, right? Like consent is key and consent changes from day to day, and we're always very conscious of that. So we always have like an intake form that goes out to all the artists every week, and we essentially do. I don't know if you've ever heard of the term lines and veils. If you've ever played like any TTRPGs, like Dungeons and Dragons or anything like that.
Probably.
TTRPGs. Call them.
Tabletop role-playing
Dungeons and Dragons.
That's my husband plays that. Actually, he plays Pathfinder.
Oh,
Um,
sick.
and uh, that's what, yeah, I well, we've been together. My whole life is just like looking up occasionally at a lot of spreadsheets, which I actually really appreciate it because it's about character building characters. So,
Yeah, I play D&D. I play D&D, and I love it. I really think of it as like the best form of improv that there
It
is, and it's
is.
like so low stakes and fun, you know.
And it's interesting that you can actually be bad at it too. Like, he will like play with his buddies and he will like be complaining and saying like, "Oh, this person's like sucks 'cause they just like are making things up and like doing the improv thing where you're just like negating everything like, "Oh, well, my troll just beat you up and now like you're dead."
Yeah, which is sort of like where I think some of those sort of boundaries and discussions come in, right? You know, we always just make it a point to know, like, let's say an actor is like, look, I do not want to participate in anything even remotely sexual on stage. You know, if there's a discussion of something and it's handled well, that's fine. But I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to act anything out, which, you know, we're also never coming in with that expectation that that's something that people are going to have to do, you know,
Yeah.
but it's good to give the writer that information ahead of time so they know, like, hey, you know, this thing is off the table, but it's not, you know, but it's a conversation. If somebody really does feel so strongly about incorporating an element or a theme of something in their show, they can bring it back to their team and they can discuss it and make sure that it's handled in a way where everybody feels safe approaching the work. And I'm honestly really happy with how receptive the writers and the directors have been to it, as well as the actors. You know, it really works to sort of eliminate any sort of power dynamics in the room. I think that many actors in a lot of other spheres can often feel disenfranchised or not empowered to speak up for themselves if they don't feel comfortable working on the material, because they're like, if I say something, I might lose my job, right? And that's
I'm
not
not cool
okay, you know.
anymore.
We don't exactly like we don't want that to be the environment that we're
Right.
creating, so we're constantly making sure that all of the artists are in conversation and have these agreements going in so that that consent can be affirmative when everybody goes into the room. And that's a relatively newer thing that we've started doing within maybe the last year or so, and it's gone really well. So, you know, we have no intention of stopping it
Yeah,
at any point.
definitely. That's awesome. Yeah, I recently watched, I don't know if you see, it's on HBO. Oh, it's on HBO. And it's the documentary about
Quiet
Daniel
on set.
Radcliffe's.
Oh,
No,
we're talking about different
but I
things.
Oh,
Okay.
no. I did just watch that yesterday, which was something.
Me too.
Yeah, that was something. But it's kind of like in the same wheelhouse of like another reason why like I like this podcast is like such a huge like anchor in my life is because like artists and actors can be in those positions where you feel like I guess I'm just an object or I'm just something that is played with. And sometimes you're in when you're in that world of just being so used to being exploited willy-nilly through like a large majority of your life, you kind of almost forget that you can have boundaries, or that people there are people out there who like really are want to advocate for your boundaries. But I yeah those that Quiet on Set and then the documentary about Daniel Radcliffe's stuntman who basically became like completely paralyzed because he was rehearsing a stunt and they like did they put in the weights wrong and long story short he like was completely paralyzed from like the neck down or whatever and it was very sad but that's all to say yeah anytime I watch these documentaries and stuff I'm just like it always it comes back down to like over communicating like people's like how what people are comfortable with and I think it's also a great almost tool like to me I think stuff like that is kind of an icebreaker because not all the time like is it fun and sexy to like go through like okay like here's the little sign the dotted line and everything but I don't know sometimes it can be like a great icebreaker for like I'm using it to like bounce off conversations because everybody has a story about things that like weird stuff and like weird jobs that they've had and stuff like that. So, but I it's interesting that you mentioned that, Serials has been kind of like a hub for like artists connecting with each other and like finding other collaborators because it is hard to kind of find certain spaces where you can actually like have a prompt to connect with another artist. It's very smart.
And I think that's why I like hesitated to say before that we've sort of like taken ownership over this thing, because I think that at the end of the day, like, it really is like it's by the community and it's for the community. That's like that's the real big thing that we always want to root into this. Like, you know, people can come and go into serials as they want. We don't ask people to audition to be in the show. A lot of the artists who get recommended to us, it comes from word of mouth, or someone came and saw the show and then went out to the bar with us after, really hit it off with everyone, and was like, man, I really want to do this. Like, how do I get involved? And we're always really enthusiastic to bring in new folks when we're able to. You know, it really is just a great opportunity to give people kind of a home base. The New York theater community is simultaneously so large and so small at the same time. And sort of being in that flux of those two different states from like day to day, when you're going to EPAs or when you're working on your own projects at home alone, you know, it can always be really, really isolating. So it's really great to be able to have this thing that people can always come back to, knowing that they're probably gonna run into a couple old friends, and they're probably gonna meet a couple new friends as well. And maybe they'll also get the chance to collaborate and create something really cool in a low stakes environment.
Yeah, I love that. I was wondering, has 'cause a lot of it happens like very organically, and I think people kind of always, I mean, in terms of improv, and improvising, kind of like watching things have like take their own legs. What are some like popular like themes? I was wondering, like, do you ever has there ever been a moment or a certain period of time where a lot of common themes surface themselves, or is it truly just like a huge variety? Because this is a long time that you've been doing this, so I
I mean,
wonder.
it is a huge variety, but I think our writers do bring in the current environment into the room. I mean, you know, the pilot I'm working on right now, without saying too much, is very much about, you know, something that's happening in November. I bet you can guess what it is, right? And so, I mean, that's just an example of like, but very often our, you know, our writers, and because especially with the truncated time period they have to write, usually it's kind of things that are top of mind. We get a lot of, and now the one thing that I think is of note, or is important to note, is that I think the producers try to make sure that people aren't watching the same five shows in a row. You know, make sure there is variety within the show. But yeah, a lot of times, you know, the themes become self-evident as the show continues.
Yeah, AI has been like a really big one that a lot of people have brought in recent months. There
Aliens.
is Aliens are really fun and popular right now. There's this one really wacky, fun sci-fi serial that's going on right now called Egg Quest: The Saga of the Breakfast Burrito, and the concept for it seems, you know, really silly. It's this person living in Brooklyn who is on this journey to make the perfect breakfast burrito. They finally do, and then aliens come down from outer space and abduct this person because they want to take their burrito and put it on display in like an intergalactic museum exhibit on like Alpha Centauri. And it's so like, it's just so like
I love
wacky and
that.
silly. There are puppets. It's very over the top. But at the same time, at the core of it, it's got this insanely poignant commentary on like the ethics of museums, which has been really like wild to see that unfold. And it's really interesting seeing the way that all of these artists take really fun like genres or just like broad concepts or maybe even a bit and turn it into something larger. The very first cycle of serials after we sort of brought things back post lockdown, the very first serial that ever premiered in that new iteration was called Missionary Man, and it was about a trans superhero in the town of Straitsville who like yeah who like Missionary Man is the town superhero, works for the mayor's office, and then tells the mayor, I am trans. It went from missionary man to missionary person to missionary woman, and the mayor fires them, and then missionary woman goes off and essentially befriends a lot of the villains who she has been pounded on since her in her time as an employee of the city. And it turns out that all of these supervillains who are largely queer are just people who want to be in community and became villains because they were also, you know, it became like this huge commentary on trans rights. And it's written by this amazing trans playwright, Meg Rosensweet, who, like, I would die for her. Like, oh my God, she is so good at creating the funniest scenarios to talk about very serious subject matter. And I think that we've seen a lot of that over the years because, for the most part, a lot of serials do tend to incorporate elements of comedy. They don't have to. A lot of writers choose to go in that direction. But more often than not, there's always something at the core that really makes people stop for a second and think, like, huh. And that's been really awesome to see.
Wow. Yeah, I really like the idea of, like, 'cause taking something like serious, and I feel like, you know, it's interesting that you mention a lot of you know, it's very, you know, commonly very topical, and it just makes sense that, you know, everybody, you know, kind of comes up with ideas that are very, like, just top of mind. But I really like writing that gives a very, like, simplified structure to communicate something that might be, like, very complex or maybe overly, like, dry, and really making it extremely, like, potently, like, funny or exaggerated or hilarious, because those are one of my favorite kind of writing exercises. Like, why don't we make this, like, bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and, like, make it so exaggerated to the point where, like, you don't even realize, or, like, it's completely the opposite of what you thought it was going to be, which I'm sure is very common with serials. Like, you just see one iteration of a serial and then it's completely different, or it's, like, 10 times like, funnier or more serious.
And I think in the structure of it itself, like, definitely helps support that, of the fact that, like, playwrights know that, you know, they've got 10 minutes for an episode, give or take, right? You don't drop everything in the first episode. You're not gonna get to your grand thesis in the first episode. You shouldn't do that, right? And so, like, by breaking this into smaller chunks, we get little tastes, we get little bits of, we get little tastes of what a play is gonna be about. And the playwright gets to also kind of go on that journey of, like, developing what the piece is actually about. Like, and maybe there's little bits of it here and there, and as these episodes build and build, it starts to become more apparent. Things start to get tied back to other episodes, right? And it's a way, you know, I'm thinking about Madame Couchet, which was a 9-episode serial that I was in. You know, the first episode was kind of, I mean, it's like a farcical. Imagine kind of a farcical Les Mis about sex workers is how I would give you your one liner for that show. But, you know, it started out with kind of bonbons and French accents
A courtesan.
and I, and then ended up kind of being a statement of, you know, kind of reflecting on the French Revolution and what the French Revolution meant in the time period that it was occurring. And it had a, you know, there's a lot to be said there.
Wow. I always find you know, period pieces or, like, commentary on a certain time period in history to be really exciting, because sometimes I will think about, like, I'll just, like, be with my friends and we'll think about, wow, what if we were, like, in, like, 18th century London? We would just be ourselves, but in a different completely different context. But it is just, like, a funny thing to think about, putting yourself in, like, an older historical, like, context, because a lot of, like, the a through line is, like, things change, but they don't change that much. Like, that's what the best thing about, like, theater is I think everyone can identify with, you know, something, or a certain, like, thread, whether it, like, be narrative or ideological, which is really interesting. So how do people, are people really concerned about aliens? I'm
Well, maybe not
concerned.
concerned about
Not
aliens.
concerned.
Aliens have just been a popular
Okay,
vehicle to talk
cool.
about other things.
But
That's so funny.
okay, so aliens are a popular vehicle. Is okay, what are people concerned about the AI, or, like, what's people are onto that, or who who's on to something.
We have a what, episode, six episodes in Science Project, right, Michael?
Science Project is about to go into episode six. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. What's that? Yeah, what's that one about?
It's about AI. Yeah. That one is about and I don't, I mean, Michael, jump in here, please. But yeah, that one is a little bit of, I feel like that one is starting to head towards the area of like ethical consciousness in AI, which is really interesting because it didn't necessarily start there. I don't feel like, maybe that was Cody's plan all along, but I don't think it necessarily was. And I mean, it's an interesting topic to bring into a serial because frankly, it's a topic that no one has an answer on right now. I mean, it is very much, you know, a think tanky kind of concept of we're watching this AI character named Max kind of grow into themselves, but they're AI, you know, and what that means and what that, you know, how do you handle something that is developing its own consciousness, you know, and considering you built it.
Yeah. We're about to see Max's first day at high school next week, which is like, what? Like, you know,
I can't imagine, because some of the AI like models out there are like very kind of baby talk like almost, and some are very, very extremely intelligent and personable and intuitive. And the intuition part is really interesting to me, because how do you make something a thing intuitive? Very interesting.
It is. It's wild, and if I think about it for more than like 5 seconds, I will cease to exist, my brain will explode, you know?
Yeah. But that's so cool, though. When do you see, like, so people come back a lot. You see, like, a lot of, like, the same faces. People stick around.
We've got a Patreon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes, a Patreon. Wait, well, where can we find the Patreon?
So it used to be Serials by the Flood Collective on Patreon. No longer, like we said, we're independent now, not institutionalized. So we'll go ahead and we'll send you the link so you can drop it.
But
we've got like a Patreon. People subscribe to it to get, frankly, good deals on tickets, because we know that tickets are expensive, and we want people to feel incentivized to support
Let me clarify something there. Yeah. Tickets in general are expensive. Serials tickets are $20.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Theater tickets, expensive. Serials tickets,
less.
Very accessible.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the point we want to drive home for sure.
Yes.
I'm always like so interested in like what difference, I mean, speaking of tech, like different platforms people use and why, because sometimes I'll go and I'll try to get tickets to someone's show and it's like, oh, it's at, I know, Eventbrite, like the back of my hand. And other times it's like some other kind of like, and I'm like, I need to make an app or something, because there's only so much time I'm like bopping around the city. But I always, that's something I always wonder about. So, but I mean, I'll definitely like plug away for sure.
Well, but even within that, you know, when talking about our Patreon, it's really, you know, talking about people returning, right? Is that we have an audience and artists that definitely come back regularly. We have we have a pretty tight cohort of kind of general artists that will give us their availability. Sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out. And when they're out, we have the opportunity to bring in some new artists, which is always great. I mean, we've probably got a handful of new artists in this new cycle that have all been brought in through either referrals or just kind of their general interests. And then, you know, from an audience, I think we're working to cultivate that audience a little more. But the good thing is that, you know, what Michael said about the theater industry in New York being huge and also tiny at the same time is that just by happenstance, because we bring in such a large number of artists for the show, we get a lot of crossover. We get a lot of mutual contacts. So people, you know, while we're trying to do a better job of fostering this community, we're kind of in a good position naturally, because the fostering occurs just by people showing up, because people are always going to see someone they recognize in the house, you know, and then they get to chat with someone that they maybe a collaborator or they haven't worked with in a while. And then they rekindle that. And then, you know, those little circles all start to like, you know, Venn diagram all over each other. Right. Yeah. And so, but we definitely do have like our folks who are on our Patreon are definitely do or dyers who are there every weekend.
Wow.
And really committed to seeing those stories and just, I think, conceptually love the direction Serials
yeah.
goes.
We
do
even
you...
have...
Oh, yeah,
oh, no, sorry, go for it.
Oh, no, I was going to... Because I'm interested in kind of like, everyone has their own like background and story and like, you know, kind of day-to-day activities and jobs. How would you describe sort of like the cohort that you guys have? Is it a huge mix of like different kinds of like people who come from a theater background or improv background? Is it sort of like a sit in the same thread of like the extended New York theater indie community?
Yeah,
or is
I
it
would
kind
say
of
we
more,
actually,
yeah.
we don't get too many people with like, we don't have a ton of like informal improvisers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, you know, there are other places in the city that are, you know, I think about like Brooklyn Comedy Club or like,
mm-hmm.
You know, Second City just opened up in New York, where those are a little more oriented sketch improv
yeah.
kind of stuff. And so
Brooklyn Comedy Collective is like a huge one.
Yeah. 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 But like, it's not that we, you know, don't take improvisers, right? We just find that I think a lot of the people that come through have a more traditionally theatrical background.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe things that, you know, are coming, people who are coming from, you know, wanting to work on, you know, straight plays or,
mm-hmm.
you know, build kind of their experience in comedy, but from a story-driven perspective. And I also think, as far as like, we do get kind of a wide range of artists, but I think a lot of the artists that we do get are people who are kind of, there's a certain amount of waiting in this career that everyone has to go through, right? Like if you're an artist in a major metropolitan area and you're trying to book work, you're going to wait.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's the difference of like people who are comfortable just waiting. And there
mm-hmm.
are people who, while they're waiting, want to be building something. And I think we get
yeah.
a lot more of the artists in the latter. We get a lot of folks who, you know, are game to just jump in, collaborate, put something up, try something new, and if it fails, great, we learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
Or we got better at something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think we attract a lot of artists of that kind of nature.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Michael, if you'd
yeah.
agree.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that Serials being like an episodic series and an ongoing series, it's definitely got some overlap with some like sketch and improv circles, but at the end of the day, like it's neither, right? Because
mm-hmm.
it's theater still, so we tend to get a lot more like theater focused artists who come
mm-hmm.
in. And sort of going off of what Nick was saying about how like in this career there's sort of like a certain amount of waiting,
mm-hmm.
I think that we're very much people who don't want to wait. You know,
yeah,
I'm
good on that.
Yeah, exactly. We're like, we don't want to wait. We want to work and we want to build community and we
yeah.
want to develop things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole industry has so much gatekeeping behind it. And I
mm-hmm.
think that as...
Open up the pearly gates. Come
yeah.
on.
Well, you know, you see like a lot of non-union artists and especially
mm-hmm.
a lot of artists who are new to the city or who are what might be considered like emerging or pre-emerging.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that with some big air quotes because I don't like those terms.
Those are so funny. I love when you read it like up and coming and like,
and
I'm sure
like...
there's been a couple of episodes I've posted where I'm just like, I feel like I should put something here, but like, why do I have that feeling? I'm just going to
yeah.
say like people are just their craft, you know? Up
exactly, because it's
yeah.
it's that thing that indicates or that
yeah.
tries to tell us that there's a very like linear path to success or linear path
exactly.
to like having
yeah.
a career out here. And I think that a lot of us have found ourselves in situations where we've been exploited, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us came from that background of being bats, and there was a lot of exploitation around that. And I think that we have really worked to make sure that everything that we are creating is done in sort of defiance of that. So like
mm-hmm.
that's why we don't have people audition. Like if somebody tells
mm-hmm.
us that they want to get involved, there's a spot to get involved. We're like, yeah, dude, come on in,
mm-hmm.
try it out. You know, all we ask is that you
See a cereal first.
Yeah, see a cereal first so you know what you're going to get to. And then also just like come get to know people, you know? Like come grab a drink, have some fun, like gel with us. We want to be your friend first. If that makes sense.
And I think that, Michael, that's a really important thing. And I think, well, and off of that, because I think that like we want to be your friend first kind of thing that we try to, or we want to at least know who you are first, I actually think can be a better way into people's best work. Yes. Of just saying, you know, the stakes are off. You're mm-hmm. gonna do the best you can do, and we're gonna support you in whatever that means. And to mm-hmm. give people the opportunity to be like, oh, I don't have to worry about impressing the room. The amount of growth that you, like the way that people grow mm-hmm. when they're not worried about trying to, like, I don't know, outshine someone mm-hmm. or like if there's this weird internal competition in a rehearsal room. Like that's not in cereals, which is hilarious because it is a competition, but there's so much goodwill and mm-hmm. so much belief in just the, like, you know, if you want to do this, we're going to give you the opportunity that, I mean, I feel like when I watch new people come in all the time and they do a few cycles of cereals and I'm like, holy shit, like mm-hmm. the way you've changed, like just in these few weekends is like, mm-hmm. I mean, what'd you get the 4-year degree for? Like,
for real.
Yeah, I know, for real. Every year that goes by, I wouldn't trade it for the world, but some days I think. that's great because it's always hard to, like, if you're a young artist or you're earlier in your career, whatever that means, it's always, you think like, oh, I have to go to stuff. I have to show up to stuff. Like a lot of people on the show actually will say consistently, like, you know, all I do is like, it's a game of like showing up to stuff, how many things I can go to. And the only way to like get your foot in some door is to go to things. And a lot of people have shows and it's like, I could go to a show and I could strike up a conversation with somebody. That's a lot. And like, I just want to, this sounds more like it's very engaging. It like is actually meeting you, like what you're there for, which is like to build community and make friends and like just genuinely be creative, and not stressed out about that.
I think in that sort of like, sometimes you do have to show up, right? That's part of the mm-hmm. game of like you have to, but sometimes you show up and you don't feel like you're wanted. It's a bit of a hostile environment, even if it's mm-hmm. not intended to be, right? Like sometimes it's just, and I think sometimes that is just part of like a traditional theatrical structure, mm-hmm. whereas like this is really like, I mean, the bar is, ooh, at the end of the show we tell you where we're going, so mm-hmm. you can come get to know us or meet us, and like it's there's more opportunity to actually, like, if you go to the bar with us afterwards, you know, we're not saying you're gonna book your biggest role, mm-hmm. but you might hear about 6 different things that are going on that you wouldn't have heard about that you've been invited mm-hmm. to. Now you're mm-hmm. going to go to some, you know, show in Brooklyn in some little basement, right? But there are people that you really vibed with, and like all of a sudden you have these people that you really vibe with, you've seen their work, and now you want to work with them again, right? Mm-hmm. And that, like, I think that says a lot of like building, being able to build that relatively quickly and without having to deal with a lot of the traditional roadblocks that mm-hmm. that you get.
Yeah. And I think we also get that, you know, you're talking about how sometimes going into certain theatrical spaces, it can feel like not the safest environment when you're trying to meet new mm-hmm. people, because I think that we get so, like, I'm not going to give you the whole TED talk on it, you know, but we get so conditioned to like network, and you can tell when like an interaction with someone is like disingenuous, or when someone's just trying to use you as a means to an end, like, oh my God, I'm going to meet you because you're going to help me get a job, or like, you know, something like that.
It doesn't even like have to like be a certain inflection. It's always like some sort of like aura about somebody. Yeah. It's like, you know, a spiritual thing. Like, you just know when it's happening, and it's always like super, super weird.
So we really try to like really just eliminate that from the space as best as we can, and think of it as like community first. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a part of what makes cereals as a program and as a community mm-hmm. very special, and why it is something that's lasted for 13 years and gone through the hands of many different groups of people because they just want to keep it going. You know, I hope that when we're at a point when Serials is no longer the show that we're running, that there's another group of people that's running it and is still keeping that avenue for community growth growing and happening, because that's the only way that indie theater is going to continue to thrive, and indie theater is in it's having a moment again,
Well,
which is
and let's
awesome.
yeah, and let's touch on that, because I think what also is so critically important to mention it within a conversation about Serials is that in New York City, there are so few places that people can actually do developmental work now. They all shuttered, right? Like these like previous institutions that were really good about giving playwrights the opportunity to develop new plays, they're all gone. I mean, the space that we're operating in right now, which is the Tank, which is I mean a great organization. I mean the one of the we're one of the only theaters left in New York that doesn't, you know, price people out for rentals. I mean they have a model that like makes sure that all artists can participate, and they're really the only ones left that are doing it. So like
It's
there is a
crazy to
need for
me.
this.
Yeah, I just, it's so untapped, and like you wouldn't think that it's such an issue too, because it's like New York, but it really is like one of the only places. I saw a show at the Tank, and I was like, wow, this is like a really, it was the theater like on the second floor, and it was like a really nice space. And yeah, you wouldn't think, but I haven't been to anywhere like that quite yet, and it is interesting how many barriers there are to accessing just rental spaces. And it's just weird. So it's like, yeah.
And
And
it's
then,
gonna catch
yeah.
up. I mean,
Yeah, for sure.
there's element of, well, there's this element of, you know, when you look at what we see being commercially produced right now, and I'm not, this is not shade. I mean, there is a place for
Not say
big, no, it really
There's
isn't,
a
because that's
place for
ab
shade.
there's a place for like book musical adaptations. There's a place for movie adaptations. There's a place for all of these. There's a place for cultural zeitgeist adaptations in Broadway. Absolutely, 100%. But when you look at like things that have actually made a significant impact on kind of like the theatrical community or stuck around, like the one that comes to mind right now is Hadestown, right? Like Hadestown came out just like decimated, like killed, and is still running, still a fantastic show, or like such a beautiful story. It took that show 10 years of development and started in like a bar basement. Like the and if those spaces don't exist for artists to be able to take chances that aren't going to bankrupt them, then you know you're gonna all you're ever gonna get is adaptations that you don't want. And so it's extremely important to have these spaces in the city, and there's too few of them right now. And so if there's anyone with a lot of money listening, you know who to reach
Come
out
to
to,
Serials.
because come to Serials, yeah.
Exactly. Please. Yeah, I mean, the Broadway is essentially like a real estate like game, and it is really weird because you, that's not like the first thing that comes to mind, but that's essentially like the real estate just like runs the, it's almost like real estate runs the economy or something. But yeah, there have been times where I don't know, my apartment's like 15, no, it's 1500. No, actually, I think it's only 1,000 square feet. What's interesting is that sometimes like these landscapes do give you an opportunity to be creative with so many constraints. But like what is makes me very optimistic is sometimes I will go to like a basement play or an apartment play, and I will be like, wow, a lot can happen in a very small space with very little time and money, which is makes me like very optimistic about just like the state of creativity. And then it also makes me angry because then I think, oh, if there were just like maybe 800 more square feet, imagine the possibilities.
Yeah, I mean,
Totally.
I watched the Oscars the other week, and oh my God, I'm forgetting his name, but he wrote he's the screenwriter for American Fiction, and he had that great quote of like, instead of making one $200 million movie, why don't we make 20 $10 million movies? And that same logic needs to be applied to the theatrical landscape.
Oh my gosh.
Totally.
I want to see the Jennifer Lopez movie so bad. I have to get it on Amazon because the documentary she made with it, because it was to $20 million and it was just like her cute, like creative project, and it's like wonderful for her. But oh boy, that is like so much money. It's just amazing what like you can do with so little. Like the greatest indie film can be like, $2 million, which is still a lot, but I mean, some of the greatest like indie
Yeah.
movies are like just $1 or $2 million, and then you can really make something with $20 million. Like, wow.
You should see what we do with 2000, you know,
Exactly. Yes.
and it's money that primarily goes back into people, you know. The main thing is that we want to make sure that people are able to get something, you know. We aren't in a place where we're able to pay people nearly enough, but being in this new space now as things are growing, you know, there's so much growth potential for revenue, which really means that there's just growth potential for us to like pay artists more. The show really thrives on having a shoestring budget, being very DIY, very cheap to make, you know. At the end of the day, our most valuable resources people, and we want to make sure that they feel valued in that environment.
Because I mean, and yeah, it speaks volumes when like people do show up and like they do return, because it is a signal that like, okay, like you're doing something right, like don't stop, which is like very, very, very positive. Have you guys always been in the tank?
No,
No.
so we the tank is new. This is actually really exciting, and I'm excited to talk about this. So, how I mentioned, the show started back in the day, bats operating out of the Flea. We were operating out of a basement space in the Flea Theater up until December, like just
We had one on the road weekend at a theater called Soho Playhouse in their cabaret space, but otherwise, that's the only other time.
Always at the
Wow.
Flea, because it was always sort of under that umbrella. And now we've been able to move out of that space. And I want to say grow out of that space, honestly, because we've moved into a much larger space now. You know, we used to have 46 seats in our space, like 50 if we wanted to have like a little bit of a quiet fire code violation, you know. And
Yes.
now we are
That's
in
a
a nine
joke, Michael.
that is
That's
a
a
joke.
joke.
It's a joke, LOL. Now we're in a 98 seat theater, and we sold out our Friday show on our first weekend and had like a wait list, which I don't think we were
That's a
expecting
huge
at all.
deal.
It's a huge deal. So being able to move into that new space, and I think a lot of folks who were sort of earlier members of Serials, earlier participants, the founders of, you know, a lot of people had a very contentious relationship with that space that the show was still operating out of for a very long time. And being able to move into this new space has really reignited a lot of interest from older members of that community, because that barrier to entry is no longer there. But the thing is still there that everybody loves now, and it's in a new space, and people want to see how it's changed or how it hasn't changed, and they want to get involved. So I think it's moving into this bigger space is also an opportunity for us to just only continue to grow our community more and more.
And it makes such an impact on just how you watch performances and like consume all of the writing and everything, because you can see like the same play in a small space and in like a gigantic space or in someone's backyard and have a completely different experience, or your brain can just be triggered to think about certain things because it's a you're kind of like engaging with these things from a different point of view. I always like love like we love lighting, we love the theater of it all, and that is really exciting, because then it it gives you like a new canvas to like think of all the possibilities at like at scale.
Yeah, and I think it also keeps us from getting like too comfortable as well. You know, it's nice for us to be able to have those opportunities to sort of challenge ourselves and step outside of our comfort zone. Because I think that we've all, it's really easy to get comfortable with being uncomfortable in a certain space. You know, if there's like one controlled element, it's fine because it's familiar. But when it's all brand new, it really like everybody just kind of really kicks into gear.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to see how that has also just sort of re-energized the work too, because people are really coming in wanting to show that this is a thing that can happen anywhere.
Yeah. Wow. And do you think like, I guess what kind of like material have you seen like surface a little bit more recently? Like, I know we talked about like a lot of topical things come into play. What are like some like, I mean, and I can imagine like one of my favorite things about theater is having like these really deep conversations that you wouldn't otherwise have if you were like in a different community. What kind of like conversations are being like sparked during like the incubation of some of these pieces?
It's a great question. I'm really like thinking on it.
Giving
us the real questions right now. I think it's one of the bigger discussions that we've seen, or at least that I've seen in some of the spaces working with some of these writers, is that they're not used to being in a space where they're allowed to come in and be vulnerable about their work, if that makes sense. I think that so often when we see things that have gone on to, you know, when we see a production of something, like a lot of producing entities, a lot of institutions are always looking for like a finished product, you know, something that is polished, something that is clean, something that is ready to go. And we're not looking for that at all. Like, you know, we really want everybody to just come in with whatever they've got and throw something at the wall and see what sticks. And I think I think that a lot of first time writers aren't used to that. And then when we're able to sort of see that switch happen after maybe like they might write a pilot and maybe they play it a little safe, you know, and then they see what they can do and they're like, oh my gosh, wait, there's a lot of freedom now. Then it becomes more of a conversation of like, well, what are you on? Or like writers will come in to talk with their actors or their directors or the producers and be like, can I ask you a question? Or like, can you guys help me think of something? Cause like I've just never been in this position before. So I think that's like a conversation that I have seen happen a lot. It's sort of like what happens when you do actually this conversation of what happens when you do actually have freedom to just kind of do what you want to do, if that makes sense. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
And I think Michael, like off of that, there's like, I really don't think, I really don't think there's like time. It's a very low judgment zone because there's not enough time to decide if you think a script is bad. And frankly, that's not the point, right? It's like you get a script and this is what you're working with. And the writer is going to, and we have the luxury of like most of the writers want to actively collaborate on it. And that's something that I think is very exciting about when you work with serials is that, I mean, it is one of the only times in like an early career or even later career artists where like you're working with the writer a lot. You don't get that on film sets. You're not going to get that on a published play, right? I mean, you're following what's there. Whereas like with serial scripts, you're working with the script that you get, and you're working with the writer that wants to work with you.
That's awesome. I mean, that's great. And also as an actor, like you feel like so like, oh my gosh, this is such a gift to like be with the writer and have those conversations. And yeah. What's really nice about like the actor writer, like, you know, relationship is that it's a lot of asking each other questions. And it's not a lot of like, okay, I have to do this or I should do this. And it, you know, those kind of things happen on more of a, maybe like judgment level, like plane, rather than like just like asking questions and having it be a curiosity based relationship a little bit, which is like really makes it fun and like literally playful, which yeah. is great. Yeah.
And even with the directors too, you know, I think mm-hmm. that it's such a wild, it's such a wildly short time to mm-hmm. put something up that our directors get put in this position where they're like, I can't question myself, you know, like it's a real don't think mm-hmm. twice situation of like, you know what, we made a decision and we're going to commit to it. Yeah, and we're going to see what happens. So it really, I've seen a lot of directors who have maybe just mm-hmm. like been nervous to jump into something new, come out with this like newfound confidence of like, wow, I can really make like mm-hmm. a game time decision mm-hmm. with my team and like mm-hmm. commit to it and make it work. Mm-hmm. So it really is like, it really is a challenge in the best kind of way for every party.
Yeah. And I think also that's interesting about the directors, because I think something that like, you know, in like leadership or like in directing plays or theater in general, people do like struggle with like the execution part of it, because there is that like, this is the, that's when like the opportunity where the director is like, has to be vulnerable. And I, when I was an undergrad, I always remember like the core principle of directing is like saying those words like, let's try, like, what if you just tried, we're gonna try this and we're gonna commit to that, and that's gonna be in that, it's always like a net positive in those situations, which is great. It's a really good exercise for sure.
100%.
Yeah.
Do people provide their own props?
So there's a props budget. It's very, very low.
It's but that's tiny.
It's like $25 per team, I want to say, right, Michael?
Yeah, like what can you get together for $25? So, you know, like usually people supply a lot of their own stuff as a result.
And get, you know, really creative, which is honestly great, because it's, I mean, the amount of, I never want a props budget over $25 now, because the amount of things mm-hmm. that we've been able to do just shoestringing it together. Like, I mean, we built worlds with garbage.
Yeah.
You know, like literal trash. Like, you know, like, I mean, but what we can, but it doesn't, you know, and doesn't look that way on stage.
It's all free. It's like right outside your door.
Yeah. It's all over New York. Yeah.
I remember in college, we would just do like, just like the cheapest shit all the time, where like we couldn't even afford ice cream. And I was in a scene where the characters were eating ice cream in the play, and yet the team decided to make this ice cream out of like grits and like water, like the cheapest, like the dollar store level.
So gross.
Like, no, like we're not gonna even eat like delicious ice cream that we can keep backstage in a refrigerator in a dressing room, which is completely reasonable. No, we're just gonna use water and some like flaky cornmeal substance. That's gonna be the ice cream.
What is a refrigerator? Exactly. We don't have the budget for one of those.
Yeah. But props are really, really fun to work with, because I mean, as an actor, I'm like, I love a good property, and especially if it's like made out of trash, for sure.
Yeah. And I think it adds to the charm of it. Like people really, they know what they're getting when they come into the mm-hmm. show, and they really give over to the convention, and mm-hmm. it honestly just adds a lot to the fun of the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know what, sometimes if I must mime some things, that is completely fine too. I'm not opposed mm-hmm. to that at all. Wow. Well, where can we find both of you guys? Let's plug away.
Yeah. You can find me on Instagram, Nick Turturro 01. So that's NICKTURTURRO 01. And I'll go ahead and plug our Serials account, which is at Serials NYC, SERIALSNYC. Michael, you
Yeah,
wanna go for
perfect.
it?
Yeah, you can find me on those socials. I'm at
Yeah,
McTease. That's McTease. McTease. And yeah, you can also, in addition to catching me at Serials, you can also catch me working with my other theater collective that I'm the co-artistic director of, Breaking and Entering Theater Collective. We're based out of Brooklyn. You can also follow them at BETHTR Co. on Instagram. Yeah, so we've always got
amazing.
a lot going on. There's a lot of overlap in those communities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can catch Serials at the Tank March 28th, 29th, and 30th at 9:30. Tickets are available through the Tank's website. We have tiered ticket prices, so you can pay as little as $20 for a ticket. If you're a student, we also have some discount codes that we're sharing around to universities and such. So there are a lot of options. You can even live stream the show if you're not around in person. Let me
Oh
tell
my
you,
gosh.
when I
Wait, where
mentioned
can
it,
I live stream the show?
yeah, get your
I want to
ticket
put the little
through the Tank's
emojis.
website. Yeah,
Yes.
you can get a live stream ticket through there.
Cool.
I will say, you know, I mentioned we've got a Patreon that you can
Yeah.
subscribe to, and we have a lot of dedicated Patreon subscribers who are like not even located in New York, who live stream into the show every week, and they love it.
Wow.
Yeah, so definitely find Serials on Patreon. We will give you that link so you can subscribe. Our subscriptions start as low as $2 a month. We call that one just like our tip jar. And then we have a bunch of different tiers that will allow you access to live streams of the shows every week, access to a free ticket for every week of the show, or access to a pair of tickets. We even have some merch that you can get. We've got a bunch of different little perks for you via our Patreon. So definitely check it out and subscribe.
Wow, that was perfect. I love the pitch and I'm sold.
Producer, baby.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you guys so much. This has been so lovely. Yeah, man, I really wish I was in town, but we'll most likely be in town in May. But yeah, thank you guys
Yeah.
so much. And everybody see Serials and follow and subscribe.
Yeah,
Yeah,
definitely.
thank
We'll see you
you.
when you're up in New York in the meantime.
Yes,
Reach out because
absolutely.
we will hook you up with a live stream ticket.
Yeah,
We would love for you to see the live
absolutely.
stream.
Yes, I mean, I'm online, so I will be
Yeah.
online. But yeah, thank you guys so much, and end scene.